Six Music. Six Music. Six Music.
This is a BBC Radio Six Music documentary.
Remember when you were young? You shone like the sun.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week's guest is a singer, songwriter and composer and founding member and lyricist with one of the most acclaimed and beloved British bands of all time. A man who helped lead that band in the creation of some of the best, biggest-selling and most ambitious albums in popular music history. He's also made his mark as a solo artist and currently holds the record for the highest-grossing tour for a solo musician ever. My guest on The First Time this week is Mr. Roger Waters. Here Roger talks about the youth obsessed with blues, jazz and R&B and his early songwriting influences like Hoagy Carmichael, Bob Dylan and John Lennon. He also looks back at his relationship with his childhood friend Syd Barrett, who had joined Pink Floyd in 1965, famously steering them into psychedelic waters, as well as recalling the post-Syd Floyd and the creation of legendary albums like Dark Side of the Moon and his uneasy relationship with the massive fame that followed. Roger also focuses on The Wall, the 1979 concept album inspired by that relationship, and how he revisited the album in 2010 for his epic record-breaking Roger Waters The Wall Tour, which also inspired a live album and a feature movie. He also talks about his famously acrimonious split with Pink Floyd and, more positively, his new material. But I started by asking Roger, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
I think my Auntie Bryson brought a record into the house. And I think it was Gilbert and Sullivan. And I think it was Three Little Maids from the Mikado.
Did you find it appealing?
Not really, no.
Three little maids from school, all be put to school, the world can be.
My mum always claimed that she was tone deaf, so we had a radio in the house, but there was never any music on it. It was used for the news and Saturday night theatre. You know, there was a play every Saturday night. I'm not sure that we all gathered round as a family, but I know my mother liked to listen to dramas, and she liked to listen to anything that had any political content, but never any music.
When did music enter your life as a kid, then?
I don't know, about Hound Dog, I would think. Singing the blues, you know. Sort of Elvis Presley, Tommy Steele-ish kind of time. 1955, I suppose, something like that, when I was 12. How old was I? 43 I was born. 12, yeah, when I was about 12.
When was the point that it became something that you found appealing, attracting, then, music?
A few years after that, maybe 3 years after that, when I discovered jazz and blues, which I did, age sort of 15, something like that.
Who was the first jazzer that you fell in love with?
There were a whole bunch of artists that I discovered all at the same time, and it was through making friends at my grammar school. We used to stay up all night at a friend's house. We had a friend called Seamus O'Connell, a couple of years younger, I think, but he lived with his mother, Eleanor O'Connell, and she was a rather bohemian character who was separated from his father. She thought that young men should be allowed complete freedom, really, to do whatever they want. So we used to more or less live around at Seamus's house and stay up all night. You know, occasionally we'd score some Dexedrine or something, but we used to play music all the time. We would buy records with any money we could scrape together from anywhere and play music, and Eleanor O'Connell would make us boiled potatoes and sausages in the middle of the night. It was fun. It was wonderful. And we would be listening to everything from Lead Belly, Dixieland jazz, so we would be listening to Kid Ory and Jelly Roll Morton and Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday and Bessie Smith, and then very, very quickly we would also be listening. It was very eclectic. They were heady times.
I love you, baby, baby, please don't go.
Dylan is someone that you've talked about a lot. When did you first get hit by Dylan?
Well, 63 or whenever it was, I guess. That famous film that you can see on YouTube with him on some American TV show just doing Blowing in the Wind, I think that's 63. and he was obviously going a bit before that. Dylan spread so quickly once he'd started to make some of those great early records.
So was he the person that made you think, I can be a songwriter?
No.
I can articulate this, no.
No, I don't think so. I would never have had the nerve to even dream of, you know, being able to do that. You spend your whole life without ever writing, you know, the pump don't work because the vandals took the handle.
John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on a pavement thinking about the government. The man in a trench coat, badge out, laid off, says he's got a bad cough, wants to get it paid off. Look out, kid, it's something you did. God knows when, but you're doing it again. You better duck down the alleyway, looking for a new friend. A man in a coonskin cap in a pig pen wants $11 bills. You only got 10. Maggie comes Fleetfoot, face full of black soot, talking at the heat, put plants in the bed, but the phone's tapped anyway. Maggie says the men say they must bust an early man. Orders from the DA. Look out, kid, don't matter what you did. Walk on your tiptoes, don't tie no bows. Better stay away from those that carry around a fire hose. Keep a clean nose, wash your clean clothes. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. Oh, get sick, get well, hang around the inkwell. Hang bell, hard to tell if anything is gonna sell. Try hard, get bought, get back, ride rail, get jail, jump bail. Join the army if you fail. Look out, kid, you're gonna get hit by losers, cheaters, six-time users, hanging around the theaters. Girl by the whirlpools, looking for a new fool. Don't follow leaders, or watch your parking meter. Oh, get born, keep warm, short pants, romance. Learn to dance, get dressed, get blessed. Try to be success, please her, please him. Buy gifts, don't steal, don't live. 20 years of schooling and they put you on the day shift. Look out, kid, they keep it all hid. Better jump down a manhole, light yourself a candle. Don't wear sandals and try to forge the scandals. Don't want to be a bum, you better chew gum. The pump don't work cause the vandals took the handle.
I tell you what made me think that I might become a songwriter, I'll tell you exactly now, was Ray Charles' recording of Georgia on my mind.
Great song. Why that song?
I don't know. I can remember listening to it, and I had no idea it was Hoagy Carmichael at the time. For years, I assumed it was a Ray Charles song. It's not. It's Hoagy Carmichael. I remember listening to it and being so moved that I remember thinking to myself, if I could ever write anything that could move anybody half as much as this moves me now, I would be done. That would be it. I would be satisfied for the rest of my life, because this is so stunning in every possible way. So I remember that.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said a Georgia. Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms are reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly. Still peaceful dreams I see. The road leads back to you. I said, Georgia, oh, Georgia, no peace I find, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Other arms reach out to me. Other eyes smile tenderly. Still in peaceful dreams I see. The road leads back to you. Georgia, no peace I find, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Say just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
I also would go up to London and see pop music sometimes. Sid and I once got on a train and went up to London, and we went and saw a pop show at the Gaumont State in Kilburn, and it was Gene Vincent was the headliner, and also on the show were Bo Diddley and a young English band called the Rolling Stones in their houndstooth jackets, in that very, very, very early on when they were, you know, trying to be the Beatles, all dressed up in identical kit.
Well, if you ever plan to motor west, a Jack's ain't my way, that's a highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66. Well, it winds from Chicago to L.A. More than 2,000 miles all the way. Get your kicks on Route 66.
Helen Shapiro and Mickey Most. What a weird team.
Did Sid influence your songwriting a lot? Because it's impossible to separate Sid from the cult of Sid Barrett these days.
Yeah, I don't think so. It was so idiosyncratic, his writing. Mm. And so not... His writing was so in areas that I couldn't have been less interested in, you know.
What do you mean?
Brilliant. I mean, the songs are absolutely brilliant. But, you know, when he was writing, oh, I've got a bike, you can ride it if you like. It's got a basket, I built the rings and things to make it look good. I'll give it to you if I could, but I borrowed it, which is brilliant and fabulous. I was jungling around, you know, and all I could manage was, like, Corporal Clegg had a wooden leg. He won it in the war, which is complete... It couldn't be more different and more of something, not just the subject matter and the everything, but musically and in every way. Because when we started Pink Floyd, all we played was Elmore James and Willie Dixon and stuff. And it wasn't until Sid arrived up in London with his, you know, kind of quirky Hilaire Belloc style, sort of vaguely Edward Lear-ish kind of stuff. But with also his, you know, he was always nodding at the I Ching or some kind of metaphysical or mystical thing as well. So it was a mixture of all sorts of things. But the things that were really... Sid's best work, in my view, is always about his sort of attachment to romance, like Bike. And it's also... there is a pastoral tradition as well, which I suppose... So he may have influenced me to write Grantchester Meadows or something like that. Probably did.
I've got a bike, you can ride it if you like. It's got a basket, a bell that rings and things.
fits in with my world. I'll give you anything, everything that you want. Fits in with my world. I'll give you anything, everything if you want, baby. I know a room of musical tunes, some rhyme, some cheap, most of them are pop work. Let's go into the other room and make it work.
Plastic Ono Band album is one that you've talked about a lot. It's got Mother, it's got Isolation on it. Was that, I don't know, not granting you permission to really dig into yourself for your songwriting, but it was such an important album to you. Is it one of the ones that was like, well, if he can go that far,
yeah,
then I'm going to go that far as well?
Yeah, I'm sure that's right, because it completely, it knocked my socks off.
Can you remember first hearing it?
I don't remember where I was, but I can remember it clear as a bell now. I mean, Mother, you know, the outro of Mother is amazing. All that shouting and screaming on the end of that track is, what is it? Mother, don't leave me, Daddy, come home. Again and again and again and again. Yeah. Mother heard me, but I never heard you. Yeah, amazing. And it's brilliantly recorded as well. You know, the sounds, the sonic quality on that record. Mm. It's a bit like listening to Big Pink or something. You know, those records where you listen to something and you go, that is so new and fresh and different and brilliant.
Mother, you had me, but I never had you. But I never left you.
That was Mother by John Lennon from his 1970 album John Lennon Plastic Ono Band. The choice of my guest here on the first time this week, Mr. Roger Waters.
This is Six Music.
Six Music.
This is BBC Radio Six Music.
Six
Music.
Traveling sector, I think I need a lift.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Roger Waters, and that was Money by Pink Floyd from their 1973 album Dark Side of the Moon. And it was that album that marked a change in the group and saw a shift in Roger's songwriting. Because there was that bridge with Floyd when you started to write whole suites of songs, an awful way of putting it, collections of songs that are becoming more and more specifically personal about yourself. And that's an intensely brave thing to do on the world stage.
I suppose so, yeah.
I mean, with Dark Side, it's still, it's a very, very personal view and philosophy that you're putting out there.
Yeah. I just saw it was a clever idea.
Don't destroy the myth!
Well, no, it was. I remember sitting in Nick Mason's kitchen with Dave and Rick and going, right, this is the idea, boys, you know.
How did you pitch it?
Well, like that. I said, listen, we should make a record about the pressures that impinge upon us all and everybody, in fact. It should be about death, religion, politics, business, this, that and the other. And
nice small themes.
Yeah. All right.
20 billion sales later. That worked out okay.
Yeah, something like that.
The accepted opinion is that you and fame weren't necessarily particularly good bedfellows. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, I think so.
Why do you think that is? Working for so long to get recognition and then not liking the location when you arrived there.
I think it was about not wanting to be controlled by it. There is a trap in success, which is that you can become trapped in it and disappear up your own arse and think you're really important and whatever. And also, it's very easy to decay in the atmosphere of the illusion that you're more important than you are, I would say, which is what fame's about. That's, I think, you know, it's about... And it does happen to people. People get blown away by it and they... So I don't regret the fact that we made a very specific play. It was a ploy, and it was a conscious ploy not to do interviews or have photos taken or do any of that. Not to play that game. I don't know if it was right or wrong, but...
It still had an effect on you. Look at the wall, look at that part of the story, part of the emotions of that is your reaction to the you that you found yourself becoming.
Yeah.
So it didn't work.
No, it didn't. It didn't work. It didn't work. Certainly not completely. But it may have had some positive effects. I don't know. I'm sure it did. I think the thing is that the good thing about some of it is, or that bit of the wall that's explained, which goes back to the old story about spitting at the bloke in Montreal in 1977, what's good about it is that it's real, that happened, and that I did respond to it, and I did start writing about it, and it did turn out to be the beginning of a really good piece of work because it's honest. And that's all I can say, really, is that you paint what you see, and if you do it honestly, you might eventually one day paint a decent picture.
All hard words just a break in the wall.
So another Brick in the Wall Part 2 was your first number one, and it has been, which is odd, it has been adopted by so many different social groups and political groups, and it represents so much to so many different people. What is it like when that moment comes in the set, when that moment to deliver that song, knowing the kind of, just the weight that the song carries?
Yeah.
That must be, as we see in the film, it's obviously...
Funnily enough, I did it last week in Washington, D.C., where I did a gig with some wounded guys who I've been working with for a few years. And I decided to do Brick 2 in the set. And it was really interesting doing it, because normally when I do it on the road, and certainly when I do it in the wall shows, I'm still using the kids' voices from 1979.
Same ones?
Yeah. So those voices are, you know, they're from the recordings that Nick Griffiths made all those years ago.
So they're adults now. That's really interesting. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, they're in their, like, 50s, you know, 60s, whatever they are, you know. So when I did Brick 2 in it's called Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C., I just started playing it on the bass when we were in rehearsal because they said they wanted to do it. One of the guitar players, it's called Greg Galeazzi is his name, and who's re-taken it. He used to play the guitar before he was injured. He stepped on an IED, so he's got no legs, and he's got one arm that's completely stiff like that, and he's really good. He's really good. And he could play the Gilmore solo from Brick 2, you know, so he said, come on, let's do that. Oh, Christ, we can't, we haven't got... All right. And, you know, people start playing because everybody knows the rhythm parts and the riffs and the this and that. So we just started playing it. And I, with no kids, nobody else doing anything. And I realised quite early on in that exercise that, in fact, the song lives however you play it, whatever you do, it lives because everybody knows it so well. And I don't know. It's good that the meaning is so completely the opposite of what the words are. That's what's so cool about that song, is that it's just screaming the most important thing in the world is education.
I hadn't thought about it like that, but you're
well, right. It is. That's what it's saying. It's anti-authoritarian and pro-education. So it is educating. That song educates in a big way. It teaches us to resist authoritarian governments or whatever influences on our lives.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark sarcasm in the classroom.
Pros and cons of Hitchhiking as your first solo record in 84. Once again, laying yourself in your mental state on the line for all to see. Do you have to write about yourself to make sense of yourself? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Is it something that you have to do?
Yeah, I guess it is. I mean, I'm trying to think. I've written quite a lot of new songs recently, but one thing that I wrote quite recently, I wrote as a poem. It was just a poem, and then I thought that could be a song, so I sat down at the piano and made it into a song. And it's one of the things I did at Newport Folk Festival. It's a new song called Crystal Clear Brooks, is it about me? I suppose, yeah, I suppose it is. It goes like this, it goes, I won't sing the song, but the poem went, when the time comes and the last day dawns, and the air of the piper warms the high crags of the old country, when the holy writ blows like burned paper away, and wise men concede that there's more than one way, more than one path, more than one book, more than one fisherman, more than one hook. When the cats have all been skinned and the fish have all been hooked, when the masters of war are our masters no more, when old friends take their whiskey outside on the porch, raise a glass to their comrades who carried the torches, we will have done well if we're able to say, as the sun settles down on that final day, that we never gave in, that we did all we could so the kids could go fishing in crystal clear brooks. So I made that into a song. We did it at Newport, and I did it with vets as well. And if I think about it, I think, yeah, I suppose it is. Yeah, it's about my attachment to my fight against dogma and my attachment to the possibilities of a future for all our children and grandchildren. And my attachment to fishing, obviously.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
I am interested in how you felt when you first found out that the Floyd name would carry on without you attached to it.
Right. I can't really remember. You know, there's all that talk about how we went to court. We never went anywhere near a court.
Really?
No. The second I took legal advice, they said, no, you can't do that. You could try and get the name for yourself. I don't want the name. But you can't stop somebody else using it. It is property and it is worth value. It would be like taking, you know, if there was a bag of gold saying, no, you can't have that. Well, let's all agree to bury it somewhere. And they just say, that is not what English jurisprudence is about. Forget it. And I went, oh, right. And that was the end of it. You know, so that it wasn't a big thing. It is what it is. It is what it is, you know. It's all water under the bridge.
It does seem to be that you've readdressed the mythology of you as the kind of dictator in the band. That seems to have, I don't know, the scale seems to have tipped the other way. People's impression seems to have changed, which is nice.
But yeah, that's great. I mean, it was what it was. It is what it is, you know. I will just say this about that. And you can't stop people writing, which was the most ludicrous bit of the story. Oh, he wouldn't let us write anything. Bollocks. It's just nonsense. Either you write or you don't write, you know. You either do it or you don't do it. But it's not something that you need anybody else's permission. You just do it.
How you doing, bro? Where you been? Where you going?
And he takes your hand in some strange California handshake and breaks the bone.
A housewife from Encino whose husband's on the golf course with his book.
You bet your eye.
You bet your eye.
Fish takes a hook.
Seed, vodka, and tobacco in a breath.
Ooh. Another number in your little black book.
These are the pros and cons of the jacket.
This version of The Wall, this show, this film, this album, the most striking thing about it for me was how you've taken a story that was essentially from an individual, introspective kind of viewpoint and turned that around to make it much more far-reaching, a much wider international
right.
political narrative. That's what it has become, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's no longer about Pink or you.
No.
It's about everybody.
All that out there. Yeah. That was the intention. That
right
was
from the
really
start?
That was the only point in doing it, really, was to broaden it, was to make it about that. Because I suddenly realised that, you know, as a metaphor and allegory, that the wall, it works on that level really better than it does being the story of some bloke in a pop group going loopy. It's much better as a way to describe and criticise. It's satire, so it's, you know, it serves its purpose much better if it's used to criticise the way we organise foreign policy and in consequence, you know, kill so many people needlessly.
You mentioned some new material, and I think you quoted a while ago as saying that you think you've got one more arena tour in you.
I may have, yeah. I'm going to start working on how that would work. I've got all the material. I've got a ton of... Yeah. I've got a ton of songs. I know what it's about. It's the same old question. I'm banging the same drum that I've been banging my entire career. You know, so the fundamental question is, why are we killing the children? Because we are. We collectively, assuming that we living anything that could even be faintly described as being democratic society, then apparently it's our responsibility to decide what we should do. The fact is, of course, that we don't have that power. We are actually controlled. The world is a far worse place than it was just after the end of the Second World War, because it has been taken over by greed and corporate strategy and, you know, the love of money and so on, at the expense of the joy that we all of us could get from treating each other more humanely and accepting that building walls like Donald Trump is suggesting is an absolute nonsense, that you cannot stop the flow of people who are poor or dying from war-torn zones or areas of extreme poverty into relatively more peaceful places with more money. They will, inevitably. There's nothing you can do about it. What one can do is to try and accept the responsibilities that we, the colonial powers of the West, have, to take responsibility for the effects of our colonialism for hundreds of years, and do something about it. The wall illustrates that perfectly, because there is a tendency to trump things and you know, to be that idiot peering over the top of the wall going, it's them, it's the enemy out there, they're the ones if we kill them all, everything will be all right. No, it won't. You know, it's actually, Donald, it's inside you. You are the enemy. All your bluster and all that crap on your stupid baseball cap about making America great, that is what is killing you and everybody else. You're living a false dream, you know. You're living in a nightmare of your own making.
Never is war.
invite you to pick the last song. The song we'll play out on. It can be anything you want. Of yours, of someone else's, something you heard this morning, something you've loved for your whole life.
It's something from my show, but it's nothing to do with me. Curtis Mayfield, There's a Train Coming.
Why that song?
Why not? It's a good song.
Good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
People get ready. There's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage. You just get on. Train to Jordan, picking up passengers coast to coast. Faith is the key. Open the doors and board 'em. There's hope for all among us love the most.
This is BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six.
Music.
just to touch you.
It's wide
then I realize
it's a wide open road.
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 And now you can go any place that you want to go.
Is a repeat.
It's the Six Music Jukebox.
Well, if the kids are all up to bed, ready to go, they're ready to go now. They got